Welcome to B2B Commerce Corner. Commerce Corner is a sub-series of the E-Commerce Edge podcast discussing all things B2B commerce through the lens of agencies, consultants, merchants, and more. Enjoy.
Hale, I've got some good news.
What is it?
We're not a one-hit wonder.
Oh, yeah. Meaning we got to our second show.
We did. We are now a two-hit wonder. And I have an important question for you now, actually, thinking about this. Since there's a lot of successful people who are one-hit wonders, right? Can we just celebrate that we're two-hit wonders and just stop?
No, absolutely not. We've got like 298 shows to go, man.
We're aiming for 300. Okay. I think this is the first time that's been called out. It's like Babe Ruth. I'm like, I'm going to hit that home run for aiming 300. You've put it into reality. So now it's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, I've been inspired by our guest today. So I think that should be our goal. 300 or more.
300 or more, because our guest, he spilled the beans. He's had over 330 by the time we recorded him and had this talk with him. He's had over 330 podcasts, and his pacing is beyond ours at three times a week at least. So he is in it and doing excellent jobs. It's so much so, did you know Jason Greenwood, who is our guest on this episode, was recognized as one of the top 24 e-commerce voices for 2024 by Dark Matter Commerce. Did you know?
Yeah, kudos to him. I mean, it's a big accomplishment, and congratulations, Jason. We are really happy to have had you on the show. There's so much rich material in this conversation, and I'm very excited that we got to be a part of this and that we get to share it now with our audience. Before we let our audience get into the conversation, though, I have a question for you about our last show, if I may.
Okay.
You know what I'm going to ask. So we had a conversation with Paul Babb. Paul played your game. He won, and he won the little award that you had set up. And the award was a pay it forward to someone in a Starbucks line behind you. Have you followed through and bought that drink for the person behind you at Starbucks yet?
No.
No.
I haven't. No. I haven't.
Okay. Well, that's your task today.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't been to Starbucks. I make the world's best coffee, in case you didn't know. So it's hard for me to get out in Starbucks. And so I have a million excuses, and I will use them. but no, I'll go. I will go. I'll go get a cake pop, and then I'll buy somebody else's something behind me.
Yeah, do it. Do it today. Take the kids on a field trip. Report back. You'll feel good. And then we can tell Paul.
No, Paul. Yeah. And Paul promised too. We if we're going to hold me accountable, we got to hold Paul accountable, because he's like, I'm going to do it too. Right. I don't want to be left alone in this shaming exercise.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So the both of you
get our acts.
I'm waiting to hear back.
All right. Deal. All right. I'll do it. I'll hit up Starbucks. Starbucks is not a paid advertiser for this podcast. Although we'd welcome it. So if you're the executive at Starbucks listening, we'll consider talking to you. But without further ado, we've already kind of introduced our guests. So we're just going to dive straight in. We have this wonderful conversation with Jason Greenwood of Greenwood Consulting. So here we go.
So today we're welcoming Jason Greenwood, the founder of Greenwood Consulting, to the show. Jason acts as an advisor and consultant to B2B brands seeking support for their digital transformation journey. With more than 20 years of experience as a merchant himself and now as a consultant, Jason has unique insight into B2B commerce, the agencies that serve B2B brands, and the latest retail tech and trends. We thought we'd bring Jason onto the show so we can learn more about what trends he's seeing for B2B merchants in 2024. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's absolutely my pleasure to be here with you today.
Yeah, where are you calling in from today?
Calling in from Puebla, Mexico. I've just been on a business trip and just got back to Puebla where we live now. Just got back last night from our trip. We've been on the road for a couple of weeks, my wife and I, in the United States. We started off in Phoenix and we went to the Phoenix Open. One of my clients was a sponsor of the Phoenix Open, so we were able to be their guests for the week at the Phoenix Open. Then we did a bit of a business slash pleasure road trip up the California coast into LA, Riverside, my hometown, spent a couple of days in Riverside. And then we drove out to Las Vegas, spent a couple of days in Vegas. And we just arrived back home yesterday. So yeah, it's great to be home.
Did you go to the Super Bowl in Vegas?
Thankfully we missed that one. Cause I heard that it was absolutely mental. It was an absolute madhouse. So we were a week late for that one. So yeah, I don't mind missing that one. Cause I heard it was absolutely crazy. And I think our hotel and accommodation and all the other things that we did when we were in Vegas, I think they would have been about 10 times the cost if we'd gone during the Super Bowl.
I'm sure. My parents live, they can see Vegas. They live in Henderson. And so
wow.
It's funny to hear. They never go down there. They're like, we'll never go down there. You know, they stay out in their suburbs and kind of avoid all the...
Yeah, well, a lot of people don't realize that Vegas is actually a pretty big city now, you know, and it's always consistently one of the fastest growing cities in the United States, and that there's massive, massive suburbs, you know, off the Vegas Strip. When people think of Vegas, they just think gambling, they think casinos, they think shows, they think of the new Sphere that's there, but they don't realize that this is a thriving, bustling city well outside of anything to do with gaming. So yeah, very big city, very fast growing city, lots of famous areas around Las Vegas, you know, obviously the Hoover Dam, lots of places to go hiking and you know, beautiful desertscapes. So Vegas is a really cool place, even if you're not into gambling. And of course, it's in the United States. It's one of the places, and I've been to quite a few conferences in Las Vegas. It's the conference epicenter of the United States in many respects. Some of the largest, I think CES is held there every year, and there's just it is a you know, happening place well outside of gambling. Industry. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I've been to that one. I walked around at SEMA and saw all the big cars and stuff, and it, you know, so that one's been a fun one. Well, cool. Well, you've done a lot of traveling. So you end up in Mexico. ¿Hablas español o no?
Sí, poco.
Un poco, dale. Okay, so we'll see how far in there. I lived in Argentina for 3 years. I officially learned Spanish when I became conversational in Guadalajara.
Wow.
So I lived with a friend's family. And it's also... I could say it's where I learned to speak Spanish conversationally, but more importantly, it's where I learned to drink tequila properly. So that was absolutely a very important lesson down in Guadalajara. So I have fond memories.
So we spent a month last year living in Guadalajara and took a couple of forays out to the city of Tequila and had a great time out there. And yeah. we lived in Zapopan, which is technically its own city, but it's basically a suburb of Guadalajara, and had a fantastic time there. Really loved it. It was in the middle of summer and it was 40 degrees C every day. So yeah, Guadalajara is an amazing city. And yeah, it's kind of almost like the Silicon Valley of Mexico as well. Lots of big industry and big tech companies are based in Guadalajara. So very, very cool place.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, maybe this is a good time to segue to your game, Stephen. I hear you have a game. What is your game that you want to play? We always, Jason, we do this for every podcast guest, so it's not unique to you. But
Stephen, the game is. What do you got? The specific questions have never been asked before, Jason. So these questions are for you. The game you asked, a great question. It is called... how well do you know Mexico?
Well, look, I'm looking forward to this. The game is called How Well Do I Know Mexico? I think I know it reasonably well. We've done around 20,000 kilometers driving around Mexico over the last year before we decided on Puebla as a place to settle more long term. So I'd like to think I know it reasonably well, but it depends on how esoteric the questions are, I suppose.
I think this will be a judgment of my questions and not so much your answers. So no pressure.
Well, let's go. I'm ready to rock and roll.
What are the rules, Stephen, of the game?
All right.
What are the rules?
Well, the rules are simple, thankfully, right? So I will ask you three questions, one at a time, and I'll give you some multiple choice. And you just got to pick the multiple choice answer you think is best.
I hope I don't embarrass myself too much here.
No. If you get 2 out of 3, though, you win. So you can miss one. And then if you just get 2 out of 3, we'll consider you a winner.
Look forward to it.
And
let's do it.
Is Jason playing for anyone today?
Jason, you didn't know this, but you are playing for someone else.
Okay.
I'm because you have calls frequently, right? So your next call, you don't have to tell us who it is, but you're going to have another call either today or tomorrow with somebody else, right?
100%. Okay,
you're playing for that person. Whoever your next call is.
Okay.
So you're going to be able to tell them, hey, I won this for you on that call. And they're going to get a $25 gift, Amazon gift card from us.
Love it.
All right. Question number one. So in Mexico, there's a unique annual competition that celebrates a traditional dish. Contestants compete to see who can make the largest one of these. It's a staple at really any Mexican fiesta, right? So what is the dish? Is it tacos, enchiladas, quesadillas, guacamole?
Wow. Who can make the largest one of these? I'm gonna have to guess. My natural gut response would be a taco, just because it's kind of the national dish of Mexico. But when you say big, I think of circumference. So I'm thinking quesadilla. I'm gonna have to go quesadilla. I'm gonna have to go against my against my gut instinct and say quesadilla.
So close. I loved your circumference thinking. The answer is guacamole. Is a big one.
Wow, okay.
Guacamole would also be enchilada. You know, I give you a half point.
Never would have guessed.
For the rationale, for explaining your thinking. I think that was
no, never heard of this. Never heard of the guacamole. Great Mexican guacamole size competition cooking, mixing competition, I think, because they don't cook guacamole. So yeah, never heard of this. Where do they do this?
There's a town in Jalisco that holds this annual event where locals make just a gigantic batch of guacamole and kind of see how it goes. So there you go.
I'm going to have to go back to Guadalajara when they have this contest, because I'm a massive fan of guacamole. So I'll definitely have to be there with bells on next time around.
All right. Question number two. Mexico is home to the world's smallest volcano. I think it's actually near where you are. I'm not quite sure. It is called Cuicomate or Cuico. I think that's right. Cuicomate is, I believe, what it's called. It is the smallest one. It's so small, you can really walk around its crater in just a few minutes. It doesn't take long at all, right? How tall is it? Is it about 13 meters? Is it 25 meters? Or is it 33 meters tall?
These are hard questions.
Wow. Yeah, okay. This is serious. This is serious. Okay, cool.
All right. Let me give you some hint, make it a little easier. And I'm feeling horrible that I made it so hard.
Yeah. Help me out. Because I can see Popocatépetl. So it's colloquially known as Popo. I can see it, and it's one of the most famous active volcanoes in Mexico, and we're like within line of sight of Popo. And when it goes off, because it's an active volcano as well,
and it's
funny because I parked my car up at this place that we're staying. I parked it up for the trip to the United States, and I had my car washed just before I left for the States. And when I came back, I'm now needing to wash my car again because there's so much ash and dust on it from Popo that people have to sweep their houses and everything else and vacuum here more often than you would in other parts of Mexico, because there is routine spewings of ash from Popo off in the distance. So it's surprising that I don't necessarily know this specific thing, because we live in the lee of four volcanoes here. We're basically in a basin of four volcanoes here in Puebla City. So yeah, I don't know that this specific one, but Popo's right around the corner.
All right. Let me make my answer options, a little more fair. All right. So it is the smallest, right? So it's not very big. Is it 13, the smallest number of these options? Is it, well, I don't even remember what my other ones were. Is it 20, 25?
24 or 33?
33, which is the largest number of these. Which one?
Yes, I'm going to go with the smallest number because you said as part of the question, you said what is the smallest active volcano? So I'm going to go with the smallest number because since I've never heard of this particular volcano and since I don't know the answer, I'm going to pull it out of my backside and say, well, the smallest number possibly relates to the smallest volcano.
On you. That right there, that's connecting the dots. I appreciate it. 13 is the right answer. Ding, ding, ding. I wish we had a little thing. You know, we have a round of applause, people. There we go. All right.
So got one. I'm on fire now. I'm on fire. I've got one in a row right. So
this is it. Hit me. It's all on the line right here.
The tiebreaker.
So let's see. I as I said, I think this is more of a testament of my questioning and not your skills. So here we go. Question number 3. One of Mexico's most unusual festivals involves fishermen using a peculiar technique to catch a certain type of fish without any tools. What tool do they use instead of like classic fisherman tools?
Classic rod and line.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Or even net. So you'll hear the options. The options are, do they use their hats? Do they use their bare hands? Do they use a lasso?
Wow. 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 This is so difficult. This is so interesting. I'm gonna guess bare hands.
I would have guessed the same thing.
Absolutely. Woo-hoo! It's bare hands. You got it. Yes. Congratulations.
Wow. You have won. And there was reasoning behind that thinking. I was thinking hard to move a hat through the water fast enough to scoop up a fish. Yeah. So I'm thinking reach in very, very quickly and grab what you can grab.
I love that you show your work. You're sharing your thinking. Yeah, exactly. Your work.
You know, I in school, you know, you get points just for showing your work, even if you get the answer wrong.
You know, you got a half point on question one for showing your work. So the rules are still the same as we age. Well, there you go. You earned a $25 gift certificate for your next person. So you just tell us who they are. We'll send them an email. Don't worry. We won't add them to any marketing list. It'll just be a one-time thing.
That's amazing. You can actually, this will actually be going out to a podcast guest that I'm going to have on my next call. So there we go. Now we're going to pay this forward. We're going to pay it forward from your podcast to my next guest.
Excellent. I love it.
Fantastic.
Thank you very much, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, that ends this game of funny facts about Mexico.
Love it. Love it. That's great. This is a great segment. I'm going to have to add something similar. I'm going to pinch your idea and throw in something similar in my podcast from now on just to mix things up.
Do it. Well, don't worry. We still have to wait. Don't tell me. So, you know, it's not a ritual.
Love it. Love it. Pay it forward. Pay it forward. Love it.
Well, I was curious if you would start with what you did in the e-commerce space yourself as a merchant. Can you talk a little bit about that and then how you segued into what you do today?
Absolutely. So yes, I sold along with my business partner. We started a business and we were selling memory cards. That was our business. It was called flashcards.co.nz or .co.nz for my American or North American listeners. And we sold memory cards. And at that particular point in time, memory cards, and we were doing this in New Zealand and Australia. And New Zealand at that time was kind of everything was expensive in New Zealand. This was many years ago. And this was over 20 years ago now. And everything kind of, especially from an electronics perspective, was very expensive in New Zealand because, of course, it's all imported and New Zealand is pretty remote to almost every other place in the world. And, you know, I remember 32 megabyte memory cards, not gigabyte now. This is going back so far that most of your listeners may not even remember 32 megabyte memory cards that they even existed. They're like $650 for a 32 megabyte memory card. So most people cannot remember a time when memory wasn't practically free like it is today. Memory cards being, you know, that are sold in 7-Eleven stores, for example, nowadays. People can't remember a time when memory was that expensive. And so we started importing from all over the world, direct importing, warehousing locally and shipping direct to our end customers with no middleman. And we were the only middleman. We were importing from manufacturers and distributors from all over the world, warehousing them in Auckland and shipping them direct to our end customers via courier. And that's where we got our start. Then 64 megabyte memory cards came out. Then 128, 256, then 1 gigabyte, and it was a very fast evolution over the first few years of that. And at that time, because cell phones, there was no smartphones when we first started, so memory wasn't a thing for phones. It was all for cameras, and it was all for, you know, the small compact digital cameras at the time, starting from smart media cards, which were these wafer thin. They looked like a postage stamp. And, you know, smart media cards don't even exist anymore. And we got into memory sticks for Sony cameras and compact flash cards and everything else. So that was my start. And we did that for over 7 years. And it was a fantastic run. It taught me a huge amount about how to operationally run an e-commerce business and how to do logistics and how to, you know, we hired a developer to build and customize our e-commerce website and how to manage resources and do marketing, digital marketing. And I was the first one, I managed all the marketing in our business and run Google ads, and they were 5 cents a click at the time. And it was a crazy time, but it was a fantastic time to really dig in and understand the nuts and bolts of what it took to be successful in e-commerce. And I still use many of those lessons today when I'm consulting with my clients, and it certainly gives me empathy for what it takes to build a successful e-commerce business today.
It's amazing to think about how quickly technology can become archaic and how quickly that changing landscape impacts e-commerce. And it's still going on today. And I know you have a lot to say about that when it comes to B2B e-commerce specifically and the need for that digital transformation. So you did that for 7 years, and then what happened? What was next?
So I went into the agency space. I actually started out in the agency space before we started our online business. I'd worked for an agency, and I was working in biz dev, and I was working in digital marketing, providing digital marketing services to our clients. And we were building e-commerce websites. We had one of the very first SaaS e-commerce platforms in the world through the agency that I was working for at the time. And then we started also building sites on OS Commerce, which is a very, very old e-commerce platform that anybody who's been in the business over 20 years probably remembers. And then the way I got into having our own businesses, I got tired of helping people build their own e-commerce businesses. And it was like, why don't I do this? Why don't we do this for ourselves? Why don't we build an e-commerce business for ourselves? And that's what we did. And we kind of took the learnings that my business partner was in the electronics sourcing space. So he was sourcing electronic components from all over the world in his day job. And I was working in e-commerce as part of my day job. And then we put our combined forces to build our own business. And I went back into the agency space after we sold our e-commerce business. And I did a few more years in the e-commerce space as an agency. Then I went to work for a brand in the e-commerce space, the largest online retailer of natural health products in New Zealand called Health Post, and ran e-commerce for them for a few years. Went back into the agency space again as an owner and bought into an agency that a friend of mine had started, and then decided after that, geez, okay, I've done this for so many years now. I wanted to go into freelance consulting, and that's how I've got into what I'm doing today. And I saw a gap. You know, alluding to what you said before, you know, I saw a massive gap. I recognized a massive gap, particularly in the B2B e-commerce space. You know, I'd worked on a number of B2B e-commerce projects over the years in my agency experience, but I just didn't see that many people in the industry who were specialized in B2B. And I saw that as a massive blue ocean opportunity. COVID really brought that into stark relief, where a lot of B2B businesses realized, oh my Lord, we do not have any digital routes to market. Our sales teams can't go and see customers during COVID. So our field sales reps aren't able to make sales in person anymore. And so we need better, more complete, more feature-rich digital routes to market and e-commerce routes to market. Some of them were even doing EDI at that stage for their biggest B2B customers, but so many B2B businesses just didn't have any e-commerce capability to speak of at all in their business other than EDI. And that was brought into stark relief during COVID. And that's when I really decided to double down on the B2B opportunity, because I saw that I started to recognize patterns in the B2B space that I had seen already evolve over the prior 10, 15 years in the B2C and D2C space. And I saw that same lack of maturity, digital maturity, in the B2B space that I had recognized 10, 15 years earlier in the B2C and D2C space. I was like, man, the pattern recognition tells me here, this is going to explode. This is going to pop off. This is going to be a massive opportunity. And it has turned out to absolutely be that. So I feel super privileged to be working in the space. Hey team, I have a big favor to ask you. Please pause this episode and send the link of this episode to someone you know that you think would enjoy this content. Really appreciate you spreading the word. This is how we grow. We're not a Joe Rogan. We don't have big, massive advertising budgets, but we absolutely want to grow. We want to get the learnings from all of these episodes out to as wide of an audience as possible, and we need your help to do it. Thank you, and now back to your listening.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of those patterns and the gaps you were seeing. I'm thinking there's probably some things you would say about tech, some things you'd say about process, some things you'd say about management of data. So where should we start? What are you seeing?
Yeah, look, I would say it's more legacy thinking than anything else. And so, you know, aside from the tech, and yes, you know, B2B e-commerce tech has been historically a laggard, certainly behind B2C and D2C e-commerce tech. But really, it's more legacy mindsets in the B2B world than anything else, because historically, B2B has been all about relationships. It's been, how do we build relationships with our customers? Because when you secure a quote-unquote customer in the B2B world, they're not a customer, they're an account, right? It's an entire account that you are servicing, right? And oftentimes, there's multiple buyers from within that account that you're servicing. And so by definition, in the B2B world, customers tend to be stickier. Those accounts tend to be stickier. It's harder to onboard them into your business. They typically go through credit checks, et cetera. They get allocated a trade account, a credit account with you. And as a result of that, the onboarding process is harder, more complex, takes more time in the B2B world. And as a result of that, those customers, once they've got through that process and they identify you as a supplier of products for them, they tend to hang around for a very long time. So their LTVs, their CLVs, you know, and they come to you to buy. They don't come to you to shop and browse. They are coming to you to buy as part of their day job, typically, the buyers on the buyer side. They have to make those purchases. They're making those purchases either for products to use in their own business or to on-sell and resell into the market. And so it's such an interesting space to be in. But I think that the biggest hang-up has been, in my experience so far, has been really a legacy mindset to how we do business in the B2B world, and the thinking that, hey, we have inside sales teams, we have field sales reps, we have customer service that people can ring through and speak to and place orders through. And there's been this very much relationship oriented account management on the B2B side of the world. And there was always this assumption that customers expected and needed to have an account managed relationship to want to continue to do business with you. And that may have been true to a degree historically, but what we're seeing is we're seeing a younger generation, a younger demographic of B2B buyer come online. And as a result of that, they have the natural expectation that they can make their business purchases, at least from a replenishment perspective, that they can make those orders online, because they do that in their day-to-day personal life. They shop online. And so they've come in to the B2B buying scenario as a digital native. And so for them, it is very strange if they're dealing with a supplier who doesn't offer a self-service e-commerce experience. It is becoming increasingly strange for them to continue to buy off of suppliers that don't offer that.
Yeah, the insight of like, the from the buyer side, that the demographic is changing from that piece. And so is it that the friction is being felt from the B2B side on those sales reps of like, hey, we're finding out this new young kid doesn't want to call us, like, and they're getting that friction of like, and if they're getting the information, and if they're getting the data from what is it like to buy from us, that these younger people are saying, well, it feels slow. It feels outdated. Why can't I just go online? And then it's just that clear to them. It's just like, I just should be able to log in and just purchase this stuff from you. Why are you sending me documents that I have to like pass on to somebody else or this or that, right?
And it's speed, right? It's not just the expectation that we have this e-commerce experience because I'm a digital native and that's how I buy in my personal life, but there is this round tripping sometimes of processes when you have to engage with a sales rep, even if it's via email. Okay, cool. You send me my latest price list in a CSV file. I go through, I look at it, I pull the SKUs out, I generate maybe a PO based on a CSV file that I then send back to my account manager, who then enters that or uploads that into an ERP system, you know, and or maybe I now need to send a request for a quote and I have to send that via email. I need to wait for my account manager to respond via email. Then, okay, cool. Now, how do I make sure that for this specific PO, I get the price that we have negotiated, that I have to go back after the products have been supplied? I have to make sure that when I receive those goods, I have to make sure that the price that we agreed upon has actually been charged to me into my account. Then if it hasn't, and I've been charged my standard trade price for this specific SKU, then I have to go back to my account manager and say, well, look, I've been overcharged. It is a speed. You know, there's a saying, money loves speed, right? And that is so crazily true in the B2B world that, you know, when these businesses are trying to do a transaction on behalf of their company, they got stuff they need to do. They got other things they need to buy from other suppliers. They've got a whole, you know, laundry list of tasks that they need to complete as a B2B buyer. And oftentimes they're wearing more than one hat. They're not just the buyer. They are also sometimes the merchandiser and the seller on that end too. And so the reality is that the speed with which business happens now, this legacy back and forth thing that happens via phone, via email, via live chat, et cetera, in the B2B world, it's not as relevant as it used to be as a sales process. And I think that's what's driving the change more than anything else.
So what happens when you are consulting with B2B sellers and you're confronting that legacy mindset and you somehow break through and they get it, right? And obviously, I think a lot of them are getting it. The numbers show us that they are in pain. If you look at some of the data out there in terms of, they know that they're missing opportunities. That's what I mean when they're in pain. So when they have that insight and they know that something needs to shift, where do they start? Like, where's the leverage point for these folks?
Usually the realization comes when they, and I've seen this more than one time now, when a new competitor comes into the market that for perhaps is a digital pure play that has never had field sales reps, that has never built accounts in that way and never transacted with their clients in that way. They've never done manual transaction processing and maybe have never taken payment via check before, which still happens, insanely enough, still happens in the B2B world. It's just nuts what you see sometimes in the B2B world. Fax is still a thing in the B2B world, which is just insane to me. Like, I haven't seen a fax machine in, you know, in the B2C and D2C world. I haven't seen that. I can't remember the last time I saw that. And it still happens occasionally in the B2B world. It's just crazy. And even to receive a fax, you know, some of these B2B brands, they've got fax to email that automatically converts the inbound faxes to emails that then have to go through this manual sales process inside the business. So it's crazy, but oftentimes from an impetus perspective, it comes from new competitors coming into the market that don't have legacy processes because they haven't been running for 20, 40, 60, 80, 100 years with their current processes. And so they're not bound by current processes. They're not bound by legacy processes, and they're not bound by anything. They are there to service customers at scale. And they're also having massive pressure put on them by marketplaces. So, you know, I know I'm only in a roundabout way answering your question, but one of the first things that we look at is we say, okay, sure, maybe we start out with a subset of your catalog, right? Maybe we don't put you, because sometimes these brands have very complex products with very complex CPQ, configure price quote processes for parts of their catalog. So sometimes their entire catalog cannot be put online immediately as part of a phase one e-commerce implementation. But that doesn't mean we can't get, say, 50, 70, 80% of their catalog online that, hey, here's a fixed SKU and here's a fixed price per customer for this SKU. Maybe they've got tiered pricing or maybe they've got a unique price list per customer. Either way, we can support that now in modern B2B experiences. Maybe they've got standard MOQs that run across the entire catalog. Great, we can implement that. Maybe they got buying increments that we need to enforce. Cool, we can look at that. You know, and so maybe they can't go whole hog day one with all the functionality and all of the experiential stuff that their sales teams provide today, but we can absolutely take an MVP approach, a minimum viable product or a minimum viable service approach to this that says, okay, let's just try to get the replenishment ordering experience put online to where, okay, cool. Maybe we don't even support request for quote electronically from day one. Maybe we don't do all these crazy things from day one, but we get like 70 to 80% of your catalog online. We get all your price lists online. We get all your product information online. We make the product information consistent because oftentimes what I find when I go in and I first start looking at these brands, their product data is not ready for digital channels. A lot of the information is in their sales team's head. It's in printed catalogs. It's in PDFs. It's in CSVs. Yeah. You know, we need to, oftentimes they don't even necessarily have, consistent relationships. If they've got multivariant products, which is very common also in the B2B world, oftentimes they don't even have necessarily a consistent relationship between parent and child products inside their ERP. And if we want to present that as a multivariant product on the front end of an e-commerce website, that needs to be consistent. And so, you know, oftentimes it's a process of working through the product and customer data sets first, cleansing those, rationalizing those, bringing consistency to those programmatically. Oftentimes we'll need to do some programmatic work with those data sets to get them ready for digital channels. And oftentimes it's a case of actually needing to bring in some new product data and bring it in from some new formats and make it downloadable as an asset from a PDP, for example, product detail page. So there's a lot of groundwork we oftentimes need to do. Even once a brand says, hey, we're ready to go online, boom, let's pull the trigger. We've got budget for this. We're ready to go. We've got the sales team on board. We're going to incentivize them. They're going to get their commissions. Plus, they're going to get, I don't know, maybe an extra percent for every order that comes through an e-commerce website. Our customers are saying they're ready to go. So even once the mindset is shifted, there's some fundamental things we have to prep in advance to get them ready to sell on digital channels. And that's kind of the foundational work that we usually need to do.
Yeah, that's awesome. If we follow that, so let's see. Now I've got this fictional company in my head that we're following. They're like, yeah, we're bought in, we're ready. Let's put our foundational website there for our products that we can put online. Right, we know that we'll have multiple phases and we'll start adding things in. We'll make the website possibly even more advanced over time to fit the various needs that we need. But let's go live with this thing. Are you finding often that that's like a full on new build, kind of new technology in all things? Is it integrating still with current things that then impacts their new build of what technologies they can do? Like, where are you often guiding people of like the platform choice when they're just saying like starting new in those things? Like, what, and I guess even what's impacting your thoughts of like which platforms you're picking, like what features are they including, or like where is often like the one of the best places to look, or you're often guiding people and getting online first?
Yeah, I would say about 75 to 80% of the time, we're integrating with some legacy systems in the back end that they're not in a position to be able to change, certainly not easily and certainly not quickly. And 99% of the time in the B2B world, that's an ERP of some description. And sometimes those ERPs don't even have an API layer. If they're really that legacy, then sometimes, you know, they've got some flat files that we can get in and out via CSV, and that's how we have to integrate with those platforms. So, you know, I still do run across those platforms that do not have a modern API layer that we can connect to and get data in and out of those systems easily. And so there's a lot
more
of that.
The cost to get to the API is one we've had where the cost to, they have the API option, but they don't want to pay for it because that, like, the cost is, it's like HubSpot jumping to the next level. It's just insane.
Or they need to do such a massive upgrade to their existing ERP instance to furnish that functionality that it's not worthwhile for them. And they know that maybe they're going to do an ERP replatform within the next 2 to 5. And so they're going, hey, let's just let's just integrate with what we have. Let's just use what we have for today and let's go. But what we do find is that oftentimes e-commerce and PIM are implemented in tandem. That's probably the most common thing that I'm seeing in the B2B world is that in order to plug that gap in ERP, because ERPs are not designed to be product information management platforms in the main, they can do it and they can be forced to do it, but they're not good at it usually, and they're not designed to do it very well. And so oftentimes we'll need to get a product information management platform in there where these B2B brands have a place to organize and structure and store all of the enriched data that they need around these complex products that they sell, and a place where they can do that work, a place where the sales and marketing teams can do the work on these products to get it prepared, you know, and get it structured in such a way that it makes sense from a digital channels perspective, and also to make them more channel agnostic, so that, you know, sure, they might start out with a basic e-commerce website, but pretty soon thereafter, most of these B2B brands are realizing, geez, we can be selling on Amazon Business. Oh, geez, we can be selling on Fair. Oh, geez, we can be selling on all these B2B marketplace platforms. Okay, cool. Maybe we can start doing some light social selling of some of our catalog. You know, we now need to start doing some digital marketing, because oftentimes these B2B brands, well, actually, I would say that greater than 50% of the B2B brands I work with, they don't even have a marketing team. They got sales teams, they got ops teams, they got customer service teams, but literally they have not one marketing or technically the sales and marketing manager, for example, is the sales and marketing manager, but they're really just the sales manager. Yep. And so they don't really come from a traditional or even a digital marketing background. And so the brands that I'm working with, and this is one of the things I absolutely love about B2B. I'm working with operators. That's who I'm working with. I'm working with people that are all about how can we operationally get up and running as quick as possible, and how can we take some of that admin burden off of customer service and our sales teams to make them more productive and be able to focus on relationship instead. And so I'm, you know, no offense to any marketers out there, but marketers oftentimes are worried. They're worried about the pixel perfect. You know, they're worried about it looking beautiful. They're worried about brand. They're worried about, you know, they're worried about CX. They're worried about all these things that, you know, operational people are not too concerned with. They're worried about how are we going to get the order in? How are we going to get the order fulfilled? How are we going to get it into our ERP? How are we going to get it into our WMS? How are we going to operationally service this amazing new digital channel or channels? How are we going to do that without it breaking the back of our business? And so these are the people that I'm most often interfacing with from a legacy technology and process perspective.
Well, I led you astray a little bit so what technologies or what platforms are you, whether it's naming platforms or the features of platforms, where are you going with that on that for when you're talking to them?
So I deal with mostly mid enterprise or small enterprise customers and larger. So I tend to be dealing with merchants that are doing at least $20 million a year in annual revenues. You know, that's kind of where I typically start, and not so much because that's the only brands that can afford me, but it's more the point that generally once they're doing $20 million or more in revenue, they actually have the resources to do an implementation at scale, and they can either take somebody internally who has a really good B2B knowledge and then also start to school them up and train them on the e-commerce piece, or get them trained on the e-commerce piece, or hire someone with e-commerce skills from the market and then bring them up to speed on the B2B skills that they need to have to be able to start resourcing internally around these projects. And they've got the money to do the e-commerce implementations. They've got the money to get the ROI. They've got the money to do a proper adoption plan, both an internal and an external adoption plan. They've got the resources to be able to do that. And I'm not saying that somebody who's doing $5 million a year shouldn't look at e-commerce. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that usually at about $20 million or above, it starts to become a super compelling business case for them to start looking at e-commerce. It's an absolute no-brainer. And they have the resources internally to be able to make that happen. So as a result of my ICP being at about that $20 million or larger, manufacturers, wholesalers, and distributors, I'm working with more enterprise-focused platforms, you know, the big commerces of the world, right? I'm a VTEX partner. I'm an Oro partner. Yes, I'm a Shopify partner. And yes, Shopify is starting to do some really interesting things in the B2B e-commerce space. Over the last 18 months, they've added quite a bit of new native functionality to their platform around B2B that they never had before. So, you know, 18 months ago, I would never have even remotely considered recommending Shopify to my clients for B2B. But, you know, for the smaller end of town, they're starting to make a heck of a lot of sense. And they're making a lot of noise around B2B. So these are the key platforms I'm working with. I'm also a Syndigo partner for on the PIM side of the equation. I'm also a NetSuite partner on the ERP side of things. So I consult, I guess that also makes me a little bit unique. I consult across the full stack, the full commerce stack. So ERP, CRM, CDP, PIM, WMS, OMS, IMS, point of sale system, yeah. System integration. I consult across the whole stack. And I think that in order to be a really good B2B e-commerce consultant, you don't have much of a choice. You have to be a full stack technology consultant, because in the B2B world, all of those business systems, those heavyweight back office business systems, they exist in the B2B world and they're a common part of the stack. And so if you don't know how to work with those systems and integrate with those systems, you're going to really struggle as a consultant.
When you look at those systems and why you've partnered with them, so let's talk about like even the basic idea of the website, right? The web platform that they're going to be, the store, right? Are there certain reasons why you've partnered with them, like the certain feature set, like why you said then Shopify, you know, was an option because it had B2B. When you look at those platforms, are you looking for newer platforms that are coming into the market? Are there certain things that you're just like, we need these, you know? Is that list too long, or are there some like obvious five that you just have to have these down?
Yeah, it's like absolutely. Price lists are absolutely key. Being able to have a price list per customer is absolutely key. Being able to support MOQs out of the box is key. Being able to support enforced buying increments out of the box is key. Being able to support multiple units of measure out of the box is key. Being able to manage customer accounts and credit stop limits kind of out of the box is key. Being able to support at the very least light CPQ, configure price quote functionality out of the box is key. So being able to manage digital quote requests and digital quote responses out of the box as it relates to specific cart configurations is really important. Being able to have restricted catalogs, and I can't actually emphasize this enough. I see this in probably 70 to 80% of my engagements where every customer has access to a subset of SKUs, or at least certain customers will have access to a subset of SKUs that is unique to them that no other customer has access to, or groups of customers have access to. So being able to restrict catalog access, or what we call catalog access control or category access control, or product access control, that's super important. You know, so there are some of these really key, what we call constructs or what we call primitives, data endpoint primitives, that have to be there for us to be able to sell in a traditional B2B way. These are the types of things, you know, we're certainly looking at when we look at taking on a new e-commerce platform. But increasingly, there's a second layer of requirements that I've really seen come to the fore really only in the last 12 to 18 months. And that is this blend of content and commerce. So historically, B2B brands have just wanted to do e-commerce. Like, we just want to sell stuff. But increasingly, they're taking a page out of the B2C, D2C playbook where we want to, maybe we've got a blog, or maybe we've got these super content rich info pages around a family of products, say, for example. Now we want to weave that into the customer journey so that they can easily access this information that maybe doesn't fit fully on a PDP, a product detail page, but we need to be able to link out effectively, cross flow those journeys from these content pages, which might be an SEO keyword rich landing page for information about these products. We need to seamlessly flow them into the buying journey straight away. And sometimes that takes the form of product cards, related products being available directly from that content page, and vice versa, being able to access that rich content from the product pages and then be able to purchase directly from there. So I'm seeing more of a demand for that, whereas historically in the B2B world, we've had a content website, and then we've had a commerce website, right? Maybe we've had a CMS that's had all this information about our company and our products, but that didn't lead seamlessly into a buying journey. And now B2B brands want that too.
Yeah. And that makes sense as everything's, I mean, it's learning the lessons of everybody else. I mean, even back in the day with B2C, you had like your shop somewhere else and your blog somewhere else on WordPress. And people have, some people are still doing that, but like they had old media subdomains, you know, but most people have in B2C have kind of merged those worlds and have brought content and commerce together. It makes perfect sense that as they're no longer doing those personal relationships and having those conversations, hey, let me tell you about this PDF, you know, we got this thing and like, we're going to send it to you. They need it on the website. And so then they have to learn all those things. It makes perfect sense. It's interesting that it's a challenge. I hadn't really thought about that. Those systems that you're kind of, even the ones you're talking about are the classic good ones of B2B commerce aren't good at content or aren't meeting the needs of content where it's becoming a like, oh, this is a felt pain. So that is an interesting kind of side that we'll see how people will adjust to that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, B2C and D2C went through this, as you rightly point out, went through this painful transition over the last 10 plus years of trying to really make a completely seamless, you know, that use that word again, but it's that transition between content and commerce. It shouldn't feel disjointed. It should feel completely natural and native as part of the flow of finding information, consuming information, influencing the buyer journey, and then transacting. Like that should be so seamless that the customer doesn't really recognize the difference between the content and commerce piece. Because the buyer, they don't think like we do as, say, for example, e-commerce managers or solution architects. They're just thinking, hey, I need to learn enough information around this product to give me confidence that I'm buying the right thing for my application so that I don't have to send the bloody thing back. And in the B2B world, sometimes sending that back is sending a pallet worth of stuff back. And so in the B2B world, that whole product discovery piece and product matching and fitment piece is even more important than in the B2C and D2C world. Because usually in the B2B world, we're not shipping one-off items. We're shipping cartons, pallets, and containers. And so that purchase in the B2B world is often even more considered than it is in the D2C and B2C world. And especially in a self-service e-commerce way, all of a sudden now, instead of my sales rep kind of being on the hook for making sure that I've ordered the right thing and in the right quantities, now I'm on the hook because I am the one that has put those quantities in. I am the one that have added those things to my cart on an e-commerce website. And so those B2B purchases sometimes, especially because those AOVs, those average order values, are so high in relatively speaking in comparison to B2C and D2C, those purchases tend to be more considered, but they also tend to be under more time pressure. So you've got this weird confluence of circumstances in the B2B world where I'm trying to buy quickly as part of my day job, but I'm also trying to make sure that I buy the right thing and I'm buying it in the right quantities to make sure that I can then sell it on the other end. And so, you know, that whole content journey piece and product data enrichment piece and product discoverability piece in the B2B world is in many respects much more important than the B2C, D2C world.
Yeah, and especially if you're depending on the market you're in or what the items are, you have hey, does this part, it's not the original, it's not the OEM, it's not the original, this is an aftermarket, does this one, is it compatible? So you have content around, I just need to know logistically, if I buy this thing, is that gear going to fit in my bike or these bikes that we're going to do the right way? And then, yeah, I'm laughing because you're kind of connecting the pieces of how you're talking about, it's the operations people who you're often working with and not the sales too, because we had a B2B client that we talked to, and our main point of contact was their marketing salesperson guy. And he was just like, I'm ready to sell stuff. Operation guy gets on the phone and he's like, no, I'd rather not get an order wrong. Like, we need to make sure these orders are correct. I'm not about to send an order to somebody because they have to configure multiple products since we had to build out like the thing so they can get all the right pieces. You know, like, we wanted to know that all of the pieces are correct. So we don't build this thing for them, put it together custom with all the right parts, send it off wrong. And the sales guy was like, well, they just return it, you know, and just like fixing. No.
And it's like, hang on a second. They won't just return it because it's going to cost a fortune to get it back to us. And who's going to pay for that? Is it going to be us or is it going to be them? And, you know, you make such a good point, because in almost every single B2B vertical, there are data providers that help with fitment, right? And so if we look just at one simple category that's very common that everybody will know is automotive, right? And Tech Alliance is one of the largest vehicle part fitment data vendors in the world, right? And they supply even eBay. When you go onto eBay and you want to see if this part is going to fit your vehicle, behind the scenes is Tech Alliance that's providing that fitment data, right? And there's multiple ways that you can integrate their systems into your systems. You can either pull that data on a relatively frequent basis into something like a PIM, and then you have to put attributes against the products for fitment. Then you have to sync those with your e-commerce website, and then you have to make those available as facets and filters. Or you can pull that data in real time based on a lookup of, say, a plate or a VIN or a make, model, year. And then you can do real-time filtering of categories for fitment for a vehicle, or you can put a vehicle into a garage and have that persist across the browsing session. So when we start thinking of the B2B buyer journey, it gets so much more complex in many respects than we ever see in the B2C and D2C world. And that's largely because most human beings shopping today in the B2C world, they recognize the products they're buying. So if they're buying a coffee mug, or they're buying a t-shirt, or they're buying, you know, an appliance for their kitchen or whatever, they actually recognize what that product is. They know what that product is, and they have a general idea of what they're going to expect that product to do in their life, right? In the B2B world, that's not the case. A lot of times these products are esoteric products. They have unique complexities for the industries that they operate in. And sometimes, you know, especially with like a vehicle fitment thing, one model of component can be just minimally different to another component that's got a different SKU, but they fundamentally, if you were to look at them, they look identical, but they will not work in the same application. Yeah. And so this is the challenge that we have in the B2B world that we just do not see in the B2C world. And this is operationally where the nightmare comes in.
So Jason, what's next? We know you're going to be a speaker at the B2B Online in Chicago this year, May 6th through 8th, downtown Chicago. But what are you looking forward to in your career, and what do you see for this year for yourself?
Look, I tell you what's been interesting for me over the last 12 months that I think I'm going to see a lot more of this year than I ever have before in my career is I've started to consult to non-merchants, and they're starting to compose more of my business than ever before. So I'm consulting to some agencies that are trying to build up their B2B capability and their practice in-house, and they want to bring some outside expertise in to help them decide, okay, what platforms are we going to be working with? How are we going to be able to solution around these specific B2B use cases, all those types of things. I'm also working with a couple of platform vendors, not specifically e-commerce platforms, but I would say, you know, e-commerce enablement technologies, where they're enabling e-commerce and they're supplementing e-commerce platforms with additional enhanced functionality. And, you know, I'm consulting to a couple of those right now, which is so fun for me because they're trying to roadmap out. They're trying to say, okay, what can make us market relevant? How can we design a product that's going to work really, really well for our customers? How do we define our ICP? How do we develop our go-to-market planning and our go-to-market model? What does that look like? And so, you know, I've got more than, I think for the first time ever, I think I've got more non-merchant clients as of right now than I do merchant clients. And I think that's the first time in my career that has ever happened. And I'm finding it to be super refreshing because it's forcing me to develop new consulting frameworks for these types of engagements. And also, I'm speaking to a couple of investors that are wanting to invest in the e-commerce space, particularly in the B2B e-commerce space. And they want to be able to do due diligence. They want to be able to understand, okay, where are these guys' product roadmap is at? And is this a good investment? Does this make sense? Are these guys, you know, going to have an outsized advantage when they go to market? And what does that look like? And why would they have an advantage? And are they sustainable, building a sustainable business? And so I'm starting to consult outside of the pure merchant space. And for me, that is super interesting because it keeps me really engaged and it gives me new insights into other areas of the market. And obviously, I've been a partner with a lot of vendors over the years. And so I really understand how these vendors operate and what it takes to be successful as a vendor and to provide a product that's going to be useful in the market. And so for me, it is, you know, just focusing on B2B alone has, I guess, reinvigorated my interest in the industry full stop because it feels so new. It feels like D2C and B2C felt 10, 15 years ago. And there's There's no such thing as a vanilla B2B business. They do not exist. They just don't. In the B2C and D2C world, we can go in with these standard design patterns at different levels of growth for most businesses. And we could say, okay, you know, when you start out, here's the stack. Here's the Shopify's, the Klaviyo's, here's the plug it into Xero or QuickBooks, and you're kind of off to the races, you know? And then when you get to this level of growth, you're probably going to need to add this and add this and add this. And here's kind of a bit of a roadmap for you. Based on what you're doing as a business and the verticals that you operate in. In the B2B world, there are a lot fewer kind of out-of-the-box design patterns that we can say, go and implement this, and this is going to work for you. It's much more consultative because they do have more legacy systems that they're usually dealing with and need to integrate with, both in-house and third-party systems that they need to integrate with. So the B2B space just in itself is super interesting. It's super engaging, and no two engagements that I go into are alike. But then when you start expanding that and you start thinking about the investors in the space, you start thinking about agencies, you start thinking about technology, ISVs. It is just a really dynamic place to operate right now. And that's what I'm really looking at digging more into this year, and hopefully bringing my unique brand of, I guess, irreverence and hopefully unique insights to the stage as well. And trying to, because I am a firm believer that a rising tide floats all boats. So that's why I produce my podcast. That's why I drop 3 episodes a week, because this industry has given me an incredible digital nomad lifestyle that I couldn't have gotten any other way. And so it's kind of my love letter back to the industry. So I'm going to be doing even more content this year. I'm going to be speaking at even more conferences this year. I'm going to be putting out, I don't want to give too much away, but I'm working on some AI stuff behind the scenes to make my content more accessible to more people in more ways. So I got a lot going on this year.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot to look forward to and watch you. So we will definitely add your website and your socials, everything on this website, on our website. And so wherever people are, you're listening, if you want to learn more about Jason, then just go and check that out. But for those of you who are driving right now, Jason, where can people find you?
Best place is either on my website, greenwoodconsulting.net, or LinkedIn. Those are probably the two best places to get all my contact details and reach out to me via DM on LinkedIn if you want. Also, I've got my own podcast as well, the E-Commerce Edge Podcast. And go and check that out. We have over 330 episodes now published. We're dropping 3 new episodes a week, pretty consistently, almost every single week. In 2023, dropped 3 episodes a week every single week for the whole of 2023, trying to do at least that or better this year in 2024. So those 3 places, the website, LinkedIn, and the podcast would be fantastic.
Jason, thanks for being on the show. It's a real pleasure.
Absolutely my pleasure. Thanks, guys, for having me. Are you a B2B or D2C e-commerce merchant? Then head over to greenwoodconsulting.net to learn how we can help you scale your business.